Okay, yeah, it's a pleasure to be here again. What I would like to do is tell about a few things that we have been doing in, well, I've been doing partially already in Madison, but in particular the last few years in Karlsruhe with some of my students there, and some of the postdocs. And it has to do with actually getting a better picture of what is really happening in the Higgs sector. And what we are using there is a general Higgs plus two jet signature. Of course, the thing that immediately comes to mind is vector boson fusion, so I'll just briefly introduce that and the goals I have in mind. Tell you a little bit, summarizing what can be done for measuring the Higgs couplings and the size of Higgs couplings. But the main part, and that's the new stuff, is really on various gluon fusion studies. So gluon fusion, where you produce two additional jets from QCD radiation. And what I want to show you is that there's actually some interesting information hidden in the distributions of those events. Okay, well, when we look at the goals for Higgs physics, obviously the first one is to find the thing. Okay, we have been hunting it for such a long time. I mean, it's really high time that we see it. But of course, once we have seen it, the fun really only starts. I mean, just knowing the mass is not going to tell us all that much. Okay, well, sure. I mean, if we, let's say, see a Higgs mass of 435 GeV, we know, we immediately jump to the conclusion it's either standard model or MSSM with a relatively high scale or something like that. It's not a strongly interacting Higgs sector, so we have some information. But the important information then is going to be, does it really have all the properties that we associate, especially with a standard model type Higgs boson? And that is going to keep us busy for quite a while, and that's really what I want to talk about. So we, in the second step, we want to measure the couplings, probe the mass generation for both gauge bosons and fermions, okay, and see whether the Feynman rules that we have are really what we expect. So we want to see whether the fermion masses, okay, really arise from the Yukawa couplings in the Higgs sector. Okay, and to do that, well, we know the fermion masses. Now we want to measure the coupling of the Higgs with fermion pairs, as many as we can get hold of. Okay, and we want to see whether the mass generation for the gauge bosons, okay, from the kinetic energy term of Higgs doublets. Okay, so here the one. Okay, I factored out the vacuum expectation value, okay, so you have the mass terms, but we also have the prediction that when we expand the fluctuations in terms of the physical Higgs field, okay, the Higgs coupling should be associated with the mass of the gauge boson. Okay, and in particular, this trilinear coupling here, the cross term, the 2HV term which you get from here, okay, which is very interesting because that's really what is telling us that the thing we are looking at does arise from spontaneous symmetry breaking that's associated with the fluctuations around the vacuum expectation value. So if we only see effects due to the Yukawa couplings, we can't really be sure. Okay, because in the previous slide, I mean, if I just set the vacuum expectation value of that scalar to zero, the Yukawa coupling is still there. Here, this trilinear coupling, okay, I can write it either as 2mv squared over v, or if I insert the mass for the gauge bosons, it's directly proportional to the vacuum expectation value. Okay, a tree-level coupling of a scalar with gauge bosons is only possible if we have a vacuum expectation value. So measuring this, comparing it with a prediction is really important. So in the standard model, we have firm predictions for all these couplings. So couplings to fermions, MF over V, the couplings to the W and the Z proportional to the mass of the W or the Z. So we want to measure the strength of these couplings, verify that the predictions are correct, or see whether there are deviations as we would expect, for example, when we have several Higgs doublets or some more complicated Higgs sector. But you also want to test for whatever particle we see, spin zero particle we see, that the couplings really have the tensor structure as given here in these three examples. Okay. For example, spin zero coupling particle could also have a gamma 5 coupling. You want to distinguish that. Okay. A coupling of a scalar to two gauge bosons, if it's mediated by a loop instead of at tree level, okay, would have a coupling a structure which would couple the scalar with a square of the field strength, and that gives rise to a different tensor structure. Instead of the G mu nu, you would have this more complicated behavior. Okay. And so the question is, can we distinguish these different types of tensor structures experimentally at the LHC? And that's really what I'm driving at. Okay, when we look at the various production processes, and you've probably all seen this plot many times, we have the dominant one, gluon fusion. Okay. So I'm really only interested here in this in the beginning of this plot, Higgs mass between 100 and 200 GeV because of the electroweak precision data mainly. Okay, we have heard more about the higher mass range in Liz's talk just a couple of days ago. Okay, so I'm going to concentrate on this region here. So the dominant production process is gluon fusion with a large K factor, even bigger than 2 in the that we get from QCD corrections. Then vector boson fusion is the next more copious one. So scattering of two quarks by a p-channel exchange of a W or Z. Okay, and then the Higgs couples to the large mass of the W or Z. Okay, then we have various other processes, QQ bar annihilation to virtual W or Z, which radiates Higgs. The Higgs Strahlung process, the sister of that one was the search mode at LEP. When you had E plus E minus in the initial state, or TT bar associated, H associated production. Actually, the QQ bar is not the most dominant one. It's gluon fusion to TT bar H, which is the main thing. We see all these processes have cross sections, which are, again, quite a bit smaller than the vector boson fusion process. So these two are really the important ones. Whether one really can see any of these is still up to debate somewhat. They are much more challenging. Okay, the main process for Higgs plus two jets, of course, is the vector boson fusion process. Okay, so again, the same Feynman graph as before. And in a series of papers some 10 years ago, we analyzed to what extent one can actually see these different decay modes at the LHC. And I think it's pretty convincing that, well, depending on the mass range of the Higgs, of course, Higgs to WW, Higgs to tau tau, and also Higgs to gamma gamma can be seen in vector boson fusion, okay, with various levels of precision. And statistical accuracies for these measurements, well, with accumulating enough integrated luminosity and assuming that underlying event activity and so on is not too bad at the LHC, so that one can also do that when one does high luminosity running, we should get into the range of something like 10% measurements of single time branching ratio.
These are typically 100 inverse.
I'll show some clearer plots in just a moment. Okay. The signature then is you have the two quark jets, okay, and just like in two photon events, the quarks tend to be very energetic, while their PT is essentially governed by the mass of the boson in the T channel. So PT is order 50 GeV perhaps, energy several hundred GeV, and so they are relatively close to the beam pipe, okay, at rapidity somewhere in the 2 to 3 range typically. Okay. So you have one very forward, one very backward jet, but still within the coverage of the detectors. Okay. A large rapidity separation between them, okay, and that's shown here. It's the Lego plot, eta and phi. Large rapidity distance and the Higgs decay products, for example, here an electron and the muon, in between these two tagging jets. So it's this type of event that you will look for when you you search for vector boson fusion events. And another thing one can use is that in vector boson fusion we have color singlet exchange in the T channel, and that gives rise to the distinctive gluon radiation patterns for additional semi-soft gluon radiation. And what you expect is that these vector boson fusion events have quite little jet activity in the central detector, even though the invariant mass of the two jets is very high, in 500 GeV, 1 TeV, or even more. Okay. It's quite unlikely that you will see any additional jets in the central detector with a transverse momentum above 20 or 30 GeV, okay. Even when you take underlying events into account. Okay, so, but I don't really want to discuss that any further today. Okay, so a few years back we did some pattern level analyses, and here's one example. These are the expected signal and background cross sections for various backgrounds. Okay, so we were looking at Higgs to WW, where the Ws decay leptonically. Okay, so any signal with two charged leptons, missing PT and two jets is a background. So PT bar, for example, W pairs plus two jets, BV bars plus two jets, where both these decay leptonically. Okay. Pau pairs plus two jets, okay, this sliver here. So the backgrounds are all added, and then finally on top of all these backgrounds is added the Higgs signal, and here for a Higgs mass of 115 GeV. Okay. Well, this is a pattern level analysis, and the full detector simulations are not quite as optimistic for this one, but the an Atlas study showed that above something like 120, 125 GeV, the Higgs to WW should be visible if it has standard model couplings. Okay, and once you go up to 160 GeV, it becomes actually quite easy, because the problem here is the small branching ratio into W pairs. Okay, perhaps I should mention here a couple of things, because I'm also going to need them later on, that are very useful, especially here for the 6 to WW channel. Okay. The first one is, when we are talking about production of a relatively light Higgs boson going into either two W's close to threshold or a real and a virtual W, like in this case, the W's are going to have relatively little momentum in the center of mass frame of the Higgs boson. Okay? So if you go to the center of mass frame of the Higgs, okay, so I'm just sitting there, okay, the two W's will almost sit there as well. Okay? And that means that in the Higgs West frame, the two leptons and neutrino from one W and the lepton and neutrino from the other W will be back to back, because in that frame, okay, the velocity of these two systems are essentially zero. Okay. So say we have, draw this very well. Okay. So wait. Should make a common point. Draw this again. So you have the lepton and the neutrino from one W, the lepton and the neutrino from the other W. Okay. And since they are back to back, what you see is the invariant mass of these two leptons and the invariant mass of the two neutrinos, okay, are going to be the same, because in this lepton and this neutrino are going to have the same energy, because it's a W decaying at rest, and these two have the same energy. Okay, and so just by the symmetry of the plot, I have that the dileptron invariant mass and the two neutrino invariant mass is the same. Okay. This is an approximation, but it's a relatively good approximation. The other thing which is important here is, if you look at the, now I should label this slightly different. I have an L plus and an L minus, a nu bar and a nu. Okay. Let me label the momenta also with these same symbols. The decay amplitude squared, okay, is proportional to the L plus momentum dotted into the into the new bar momentum times L minus dot mu. Okay. So what happens now is that the k amplitude squared is largest if the invariant mass of the lepton and the neutrino from the other decay are maximal, and the same for the L minus and the neutrino. Okay, that means that the L plus likes to be just opposite from the new bar. So the L plus and the new bar like to anti-line up. Okay, but that forces the L minus into the same direction as the L plus, because this new bar recoils against this L minus. Okay, and so what you see is that the L plus L minus, okay, tend to be close in angle, and so the new bar. So what you expect for these decays is a relatively small invariant mass of the L plus L minus, and also a small angle, okay, between the L plus and the L minus. And these are things that one can exploit in order to beat the background. Okay. And those types of cuts have been already imposed to actually make this plot. Okay. That's why the signal to background actually is not so bad there. And the second thing is this fact that the LL and the new bar mass is roughly the same. Okay, that is used in order to define this transverse mass variable, which is plotted there.
But the alignment of the two charged leptons, which is in the rest frame of the decaying frame.
Yes, but of course the invariant mass is going to be the same everywhere. Yeah, of course. Now the whole thing is going to get boosted. Okay, but even after the boost, you're going to have a relatively small angle between the two charged leptons. Okay, so that's also true in the lab.
So how much did it actually help your signal squared over background or whatever when you did these extra matrix element type motivated tests?
I would have to
before you did that.
Okay, I would have to look at what each cut actually did, but we're talking about factors of 10 or 50 or something like that. So they're huge improvements.
Okay, a vast difference. It's a
vast difference in that plot. Okay, which is also this back-to-backness which I'm using here. Okay. You lose that once you get well above threshold. So if I talk about the Higgs with a mass above 200 GeV or so, these things don't work so well anymore. Okay, and that's why the signal to background for, let's say, 160 GeV Higgs in the WW channel is much better than for 250 or 300 GeV Higgs in this channel. Okay, but we are mostly interested in the lower mass range, so it doesn't matter for us right now. Okay, another example I would like to show is Higgs to tau tau, and we can play another trick, namely the taus of course decay into one or two neutrinos plus additional stuff, either electrons, muons, and we have two neutrinos, or some hadrons. I guess we still have the tau neutrino. So you always have missing PT. You lose at least two neutrinos, perhaps even up to four neutrinos in the case of the two taus. So at first sight, you think you cannot reconstruct the invariant mass of the taus. But the situation actually isn't so bad. Okay, so let's look at the tau tau case. What you have is two jets, so from the two quarks in these events, and then they recoil against the two taus. Okay? And the Higgs momentum is this one here. Okay, I do this in the transverse plane, so I have the PT of the Higgs as this one. The question is, how much do we actually see of that? Well, what we see is only this isn't distinct enough. Okay, so let's say we see an L minus here and an L plus there, and the rest here is neutrinos. Okay, so we don't know this stuff. Okay, we only know these two here. But what helps us a lot is that the taus are relatively light particles. Okay, we're talking about Higgs masses here in the 100-140 GeV range. Okay, that means that the taus and the decay have a typical energy of 60-70 GeV. They are highly boosted, large gamma factor, which means the decay product, since they have a mass of only 2 GeV, okay, are essentially all boosted into the same direction. They line up to a very good degree of accuracy. Okay? That means even though we cannot see the neutrinos, we know that in a tau decay, the neutrinos go basically into the same direction as the observed decay products of the tau, be it charged leptons or pions or what have you. Okay? So we know the direction of the neutrinos, and now we have the neutrinos make themselves felt by PT miss in the event. So the PT miss plus the momenta of the two leptons add up to the Higgs momentum. So we actually know this parallelogram. Okay, and from this parallelogram, okay, we have these directions of these two sides. We can then measure the length of these sides here. Okay, and that's exactly what is given here in this equation. Okay, so x1 and x2 are the measured energy, are the energy fractions of the tau, which are carried by the visible decay products. And from the parallelogram, okay, we see what the overall transverse momentum of each of the taus is. So we can actually calculate x1 and x2. Okay, then the momentum of the tau is just the observed momentum here of the L minus divided by x1. Okay, and so the invariant mass is the invariant mass of the two leptons divided by x1 times x2. We can reconstruct the tau per invariant mass. Okay, of course, the accuracy with which this can be done depends on how well we can actually measure this parallelogram. And the limiting factor here is always the measurement of the missing transverse momentum in those events.
Okay. You have to break up the missing momentum along one of the tau and the other, because the one measurement.
Okay, I have this parallelogram in the transverse plane. Okay, and so I know these directions. So what you see is this direction, that direction, and you know this overall transverse momentum vector. Okay, and so now I just project back parallel to this line onto the two directions, and I know what momentum the overall tau should have had, and then I can calculate what x1 is. Yeah, what I need is that the two decay directions are not parallel to each other. Then the accuracy is going to go down the drain. Okay. And the other thing is, if I have mismeasurement of the transverse of the missing PT, that is going to lead to a bad reconstruction of these two also. Okay. So the resolution that is expected for CMS and Atlas is of the order of some 15%, let's say. Okay, just a rough estimate.
The transverse momentum of the Higgs, which you're relying on, depends on knowing that in the event, that the Higgs and two jets are not the last, right?
The Higgs, two jets, and underlying event.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, and for the accuracy here, I mean, you really have to take additional soft gluon radiation into account as well.
How good an approximation is it to say that there isn't stuff that's going down the beam pipe that you just don't see?
That of course is part of the reason why the transverse momentum, or the missing PT, okay, has. So this is from an experimental analysis. Okay, this shows the reconstruction of these momentum fractions x1 and x2. Okay, symmetry. It should always be below 1 here for actual Higgs to tau events, but you see, you have some stuff which goes the wrong way, some stuff which is negative. But see, for backgrounds, if you to do W pairs plus jets, okay, then there will be a lot of events here which are actually unphysical, and that helps to throw them out. And also, there's a lot of stuff here with too large x values which are unphysical. Okay, so all that helps you to throw out background events. And so this is from CMS analysis for hadronic decay of one of the taus. This is from ATLAS for double leptonic decay. Okay, and you see the resolution that you have. Ideally, you would have an extremely narrow peak here because the Higgs mass is or the Higgs decay width is essentially negligible. Okay, but it's washed out to something like a 15% or so mass resolution. There should be two W's here. Okay, so you have two W's which decay both leptonically, for example. Okay, and so you can reconstruct this invariant mass. The reason why in ATLAS it doesn't look so good is because X mass is 120, here it's 135. Okay, so there's a larger difference here between the Z peak and the Higgs to tau tau. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And 140 is, you can do this probably up to 145 or something like that. Yeah. Jets faking tau are included there. I mean, here it's not an issue. Here. Well, this is just for one particular background. I mean, this actually should read W. This is VVJJ. Okay. Not WJJ.
Peter?
Yeah.
I mean, let me just be nasty. That spot right there, and I'm in CMS. As I understand that, the scale is one event per bit.
Yes.
Right. So that plot has a beautiful shape because it's not reflecting statistical fluctuations.
Yes.
That you would actually get in a 30-inverse femton, for example.
You don't do this with 30-inverse femton in this one channel.
You do this, what?
You need additional, you have to combine various channels, okay? So the decay of one tau leptonically, the other one hadronically, both taus decaying leptonically, and you have to wait for more integrated luminosity. That's
okay,
correct.
Let me just make two points that are probably obvious. One is that very nice shape that you have there isn't what it would look like with a sample of 30 inverse.
That's right, yes.
Because it would have much more rattiness. That nice shape there makes you think that you've got a lot of data. It was done with a higher integrated luminosity sample and then scaled down to 30 inverse femtobar, right?
Yes.
Then it has to be, otherwise.
Yeah.
So the total number of events under that peak is just like a few.
Yeah, some 6-7 events for that integrated luminosity.
So, you know, when you're doing an analysis and the number of events is a few, then all sorts of hell breaks out with all kinds of other stuff that you didn't think about. I mean, just to put the perspective on here, that
I'm not saying that this is a an easy analysis. I mean, it's obvious that this is something that you will not do in the first year. After 3 years, perhaps you'll do that. Okay, and it does take a detector that is well understood, because we do rely on missing PT and so on. Okay. So this is a plot from ATLAS, okay, 30 inverse femtobarn, okay, and this Higgs to tau tau sensitivity, okay, that's this blue curve here. So they expect that combining the different Higgs to tau tau channels, okay, they get just about to a little bit above 5 sigma here for Higgs masses between 120 and 140. Okay. It also tells you what happens when you go to higher Higgs masses, how this eventually is going to drop off.
Purple curve, which is the
Tiki
bar
hit.
And that's pretty much
yes.
Over. That's
right.
Pretty
yeah.
Present from both Atlas and CMS, as if the feasibility indicated there is not at all.
Mm-hmm.
Because of just the sort of thing I was mentioning is very naive estimation of backgrounds in these early studies. So you should not take that seriously.
Mm-hmm. The thing that, okay, there's also some positive news. Okay,
yeah.
This curve is too pessimistic.
Uh-huh.
That's x to gamma, because there's the k factor of 2 is not included there. Okay. But of course, what is important is that, especially in this region here, so above some like 120 GeV, we have a variety of different channels where we hope to see the Higgs. Okay, so Higgs to tau in vector boson fusion, Higgs to WW in vector boson fusion, then this should be Higgs to ZZ to 4 leptons, mostly in gluon fusion. Okay, Higgs to gamma, mostly from gluon fusion, and so on. Okay. And so the point is, one can combine all that data to get first measurements on the strength of the Higgs couplings. Not that much. Okay, it looks better than this plot here because CMS is plotting a K factor. Okay, I think Atlas by now may also plot a K factor. Okay, but of course the resolution is somewhat better, but the effect is not huge from what I've seen. Would you agree with that, or?
I don't know. I mean, Atlas has a pretty good calorimeter too.
Yeah.
So, in fact, it's much better on missing ET.
Because also what?
Yeah.
Of course, but it's not just the quality of the calorimeter. It also is a question: how much material do you have before the calorimeter? Okay. So how much conversion do you have? And so it's a complicated question. Okay. Well, this is an alternative way to show the previous thing, and there are perhaps a few too many curves on here, and probably the TTH I should throw out, and I made this plot a few years ago. What this shows is the expected statistical accuracy after each of the detectors have accumulated 100 inverse femtobarn of data, so 200 inverse femtobarn total. Okay. And also, it is assuming that we can do vector boson fusion even with a modest amount of pileup. Of course, we don't know how 100 inverse femtobarn, how this is going to be divided into 10 to the 33, 2 times 10 to the 33, 10 to the 34 luminosity running. We don't really know yet how much underlying event we really have at the LHC. Okay. So there's a caveat on the jet activity here. But assuming that also at a higher luminosity running we can use the vector boson fusion, this is the statistical power you have. Okay, especially Higgs to WW in vector boson fusion, you are going to get a lot of events. So there we are talking about 1,000 events or more. Higgs to tau, that should be, that's this green curve which is barely visible. Okay. 100 inverse femtobarn update, then we are talking about some like 200 events or so combined in the two experiments. X to gamma, inclusive, and from vector boson fusion. Okay. X to WW, that's the inclusive, so mostly gluon fusion. There was some analysis of TT bar H with H to WW, which I included here, but the errors there are large. You see here, you have lots of different channels that, in principle, you can where you can combine the information.
But I'm confused. What? Okay, there's Higgs to WW and then Higgs to WW.
Yeah. The dotted line was a TT bar H analysis. Okay. And the solid line is from gluon fusion. Okay. So in principle, you can see Higgs to WW decay in three different channels when the Higgs is produced in association with two tops, with from gluon fusion inclusive, and from vector boson fusion. I think these two lines are pretty uncontroversial. It's not so clear how useful that is, whether you can actually do that. That was just the Parton level analysis here.
Interpreting it is really rather complicated, right? Because the gluon fusion signal presumably has a number of events, but a large background,
yes,
and an uncertainty in how well we actually know what we're doing.
Yes,
where
that's why I was.
The argument is that the two jet clusters, while the number of events is lower, the background is lower, and you think things are under better control. In theory.
Yeah, and so the reason why. Here, the accuracy is lower than for the vector boson fusion, even though the number of events here intrinsically is larger, is that you have to think of the uncertainties of the background in the subtraction. Okay? That's also why here in the flanks, the accuracy goes down, because you have a much worse signal to background ratio. And also things like maybe these two leptons being close together because of the structure doesn't work as good anymore once you are up here. Okay, but I mean, it's clear this picture should only give you a rough impression. Okay, namely, we can measure a whole bunch of different cross sections with accuracies up to something like 10%. Okay, and that is going to give us a lot of information, given the fact that right now we really have no idea how large the Higgs-Yukawa couplings, how large the various partial decay widths are. Okay. So even a factor 2 measurement of some of these things are going to be useful. If we can get down to the 10% level, it's really useful.
One more question. Just to make sure I understand the question. So for example, on the left, there's that black line that says WHH2. That's not any of the categories of gluons.
Yeah, right.
I see. It doesn't live in all
right. So that was another Parton level analysis which I included there. Okay.
But the dB bar there does rely on the dB bar case.
Yeah. This actually I should have scratched. This is the old analysis from CMS for Higgs to dB bar. Okay. So. Forget that line there. It's also not important for the next few slides because it didn't really include it. Okay. The important ones are Higgs to gamma gamma, vector boson fusion and inclusive. Then Higgs to tau tau, especially in vector boson fusion. That is very important. So it's really important that one tries as hard as possible to measure that particular process. Okay. And then Higgs to WW in the two different channels, of course, are very important. Higgs to ZZ is important. No. I think that's going to, well, okay, one can try that. Okay. But for these analyses, actually, it wouldn't really do you much good, especially since in leptonic decays to the taus, the information that you could use is if you measure the polarization of both taus simultaneously. Okay. If you know that one is left chiral, the other one is right chiral. Okay. But since you have to see at least one of the taus going leptonically because of background issues, okay, and leptonic tau decays are not very good polarization analyzers, I don't think it's going to be a very useful thing. Okay, there's another. Now let's see how well can we measure the various couplings. There's one general problem when you try to do it at the LHC, okay? And that's you can never be quite sure that you have actually seen the important channels, especially Higgs to BB bar. You usually don't see. Okay, you don't have an inclusive measurement of the Higgs production cross section like you would have at the linear collider. Okay, so if you look at the previous plot, we have several products of signal production cross section times branching ratio, let's say into a pair of particles, which I call x here. Partial width, the branching ratio would be the partial width into the x pair divided by the total width. Okay, and the production cross section Well, the production cross section has the same coupling to the particles that actually produce the Higgs as in the corresponding decay process. So in the ratio of the cross section divided by the partial width, okay, unknown couplings largely drop out. Okay, so I can write this product in any model, okay, as the standard model ratio of production cross section divided by decay width times the decay width in the actual model I'm interested in. Okay, this stuff here is standard model, so I can calculate it. This is the stuff then that contains the information that I want to measure. So it's always these products, product of two partial widths divided by the total width. And I can parameterize the knowledge this way. And now you see the problem. If I go to, imagine you have measured a bunch of these. Okay. If I go to a model where I scale up the all partial widths by a common factor f, and the total width by a factor f squared, then obviously all these ratios stay the same. Okay? And I can do that because I can add some additional stuff which I just haven't seen. Okay? For example, Higgs to glue, let's make it Higgs to light quarks, which I can't really measure, might be larger than what I expect. Okay? And so, when I tried to do a fit now to individual partial widths, and of course the gamma here is the sum of these partial widths, okay, then because of this problem here, I will always get insensitive directions. Okay? There are some bounds to what kind of factor f I can have. Of course, the total width has to be at least the sum of the partial widths where I can actually directly see things. Okay. And the total width cannot be that large that it exceeds the experimental resolution. But those are relatively weak bounds. Okay. So what means that the this factor f cannot be much larger than factor 20, 30 or so. Okay. Not much smaller than order 1. Okay. But it's going to give me insensitive directions. And that means if I want to do a fit, I have to make additional assumptions. Okay. Otherwise, I have these insensitive directions in the error ellipsoid. And we have tried two different things. In the first paper we wrote about that, we were assuming that, for example, the Higgs to tau to Higgs to BB coupling. If you think of general 2x doublet models, or at least SUSY models, I should say, that ratio is the same as in the standard model, because both the tau and the b are isospin minus I3 equal minus 1/2 third generation fermions. The mass is generated the same way. Okay? Also, Higgs to WW to Higgs to ZZ, the factor of sine alpha minus beta drops out. Okay? So that's the standard model value. And let's assume there are no exotic channels. Then by combining the information, you can get can extract partial widths with accuracies in the 10 to 20% level, okay? Assuming the accuracies I was giving before. Now, you wiggle a little bit around those accuracies. Let's say I was too optimistic by a factor 2 in some of the accuracies. Well, you still get order 20% measurements of partial widths and therefore of coupling squared, so 10% measurements of couplings.
Fairly general,
as long as you can isolate. Yeah, right. Right. So this one is pretty uncontroversial. Here, once I go, for example, to SUSY and I have some loop effects, I can violate that assumption. Okay. So it is true at tree level in SUSY. Okay. Some people didn't like these assumptions, so we did another exercise. Okay. Go to specific models and let's ask the question, how well can we distinguish them from the standard model? Okay, so the particular model here is the MHMAX scenario that was used in the lab analyses, and what I'm showing here is essentially sensitivities as of in the MA tan beta plane, okay, assuming different types of integrated luminosities here. So 2 times 30, that means, measurement here is, the weak boson fusion is very, very important, okay? So if you can't use weak Poisson fusion at very high luminosity because of pileup effects, okay, you might be stuck there. So that's the pessimistic scenario. Somewhat more optimistic is 300 inverse femtobarn eventually for all the other channels, but only 100 inverse femtobarn effective for vector boson fusion, or full luminosity including vector boson fusion. Okay, you see the 3 sigma sensitivity that you get reaches up to order Ma masses of something like 300 to 400. Okay, the reason why you are sensitive is mostly the following. What happens is that the decoupling for the Higgs, the light Higgs coupling, we are only talking about the light Higgs, to W's and Z's, that decouples quite rapidly, especially when you go to large tan beta. Okay? So those vertices are, and also Higgs to gamma-gamma, which is induced by it, are essentially standard model strength very early on, say above 200 or so. The H to BB bar and H to tau tau couplings, on the other hand, they decouple much more slowly. Okay? So you will still have, let's say, at tan beta of 20 or 30 and MA of 200, you will have almost a factor 2 difference in those couplings. Okay? So what that means is that, okay, these couplings don't change, but these become larger. Okay? That means the partial width to BB bar and tau tau increases. In the standard model, they essentially saturate the branching ratio already. Okay? They still will do in this scenario. Okay? But their importance is much bigger compared to that. So even though these partial widths don't change, the branching ratios here go down. And these branching ratios essentially stay put. Okay? So what you'll see is a tau tau rate slightly larger than what you expect in the standard model. Probably not statistically significant, but a clearly suppressed rate for WW and gamma gamma. Okay, and that's where most of the sensitivity comes from. Okay, so the measurement of the H to tau tau coupling is absolutely crucial to have some indirect sensitivity here, and also in this region where this is the whole region where you only see the light Higgs in the LHC analyses. Okay. You, tan beta is too small to produce the capital H or the capital A. Yeah.
By HWW, are you also meaning to include HWB in that also?
Yeah. Yeah. So HCZ here is tied to it. Yeah. Right.
Well, I'm a little confused about the part. Why do you have both horizontal and vertical?
Oh, okay. These are the sensitivity lines. So below here, let's say with this integrated luminosity, I have 3 sigma or more significance. The horizontal line just indicate, okay, this is the line of MH equal 130. This is the line of MH equal 125, 120. Sorry. Yeah. Right. Okay. Well, I'm going a little bit slower than I anticipated. Let's go to the main subject of the talk. Okay, which is gluon fusion. See, after all, beyond the vector boson fusion, there's another source of Higgs plus 2 jet events, gluon fusion. The question is, can one distinguish the two? Can one use both in order to get useful information? Okay, and so let's concentrate on this and correlated graph. So this is the one I showed before. Of course, there are lots of other processes. Gluon quark scattering, glue to glue Higgs, and so on. And in the calculation, all these different things are included. For the CP even Higgs, this is a calculation I did some 6 years ago, 6-7 years ago, with these people here. And let me first show a few results from that calculation. What I'm going to show in the following are 2 different sets of cuts, just to give you an impression. One is what I call inclusive cuts. So that's just asking, you see at least 2 jets inside the detector with reasonable separation of the jets. Okay, and that's it. Higgs decay product, okay, the Higgs does whatever it wants. Okay. The second one is, how important is the glue to Higgs, plus 2 jets, in the vector boson fusion region? Okay. we would want to isolate the vector boson fusion and not have a contamination here from this gluon fusion process. So typical vector boson fusion cuts on top of that would be requiring the separation in rapidity of the two jets to be large enough, something like 4 units, so we took 4.2 here, in opposite detector hemispheres and with a large invariant mass. So digest invariant mass of the two jets above 600 GeV. Okay. Okay. Why is this technical? So let's look at the at these plots. What is shown here, the solid line, is the result of our calculation with inclusive cuts. Okay. So you have cross sections in the 10 picobahn region. Okay. Down here is the vector boson fusion process cross section. Okay. So quite a bit lower. But now when you go to vector boson fusion cuts, the vector boson fusion is up here. Okay. And the gluon fusion is down here. Okay. So with vector boson fusion cuts, you enhance the we're really interested only in this region here. You enhance the vector boson fusion over the gluon fusion contribution. Okay. To about factor 3 larger than the gluon fusion. Okay. So without additional tricks like central jet veto, you still expect something like a 30% contamination from gluon fusion plus two jet events in the vector boson fusion sample. But you can use now central jet veto techniques and so on to try to suppress this further. Okay. So the first thing is the gluon fusion needs to be taken into account, gluon fusion plus two jets, but it's not going to kill the measurements of the vector boson fusion. Another point here, the green curve, okay, that's the result of the large MT limit. Okay. So the large MT limit here is okay for Higgs masses below about the top mass. Okay. But once you get above the top mass, it's there are large corrections. And that's also the case when you look at distributions. This is the PT distribution of the maximum PT of the two additional jets. Okay. In the full calculation and in the large top mass limit. Okay. You see, for PTs above 200 GeV, you start getting into trouble. Okay. So the in the MT going to infinity approximation, that's the only thing that we actually have so far, including next to leading order QCD corrections. Okay. That calculation is only valid if you have relatively small Higgs masses below the top mass and also relatively small transverse momenta of the jets. Incidentally, for the two-jet invariant mass, which has become really large, the large top mass limit, okay, that's the green, almost indistinguishable, okay, that actually is a very good approximation for that distribution. But you do see it in the transverse momentum distribution. Okay, we have extended that now, and that's some more recent results done by one of my students in Karlsruhe. To extend this to a pseudoscalar Higgs production. Okay, so same calculation. Okay, and if you want to ask the question, okay, what about A production in SUSY? Well, especially in large tan beta, B quark loops are going to be important. So we have B quark loops in there, top loops, interference of the two. Okay, and also at the same time, we have implemented now both the CP even and the CP odd couplings. So CP violation in the Higgs sector can also be implemented. Okay, this is just for the CP odd contribution, just the gamma 5 term.
Do you include the B quark as a quark sign?
Yes.
So there are contributions at large 10 beta which are initiated by...
No, that is not included in these plots. That would be considered a separate process. So this is only the loop-induced process. So the D parton is inside the loop, okay, but not as an external particle. Yes, yeah, at large tan beta, that is going to give a sizable contribution to the cross section. Okay. Okay. What is shown here is essentially the influence of the mass which is going around inside the loops. tan beta equal to 1, top quark dominates. Okay, so as a function of MA in this peak here, that's exactly where you cross the PT bar threshold. That's the same type of peak that we saw in the inclusive fixed production cross section before. Okay, but then as you go up in tan beta, so 7 is kind of the worst case because the top is suppressed by 1 over tan beta, the B is enhanced by a tan beta, but it's not really important yet. Okay, so you get a huge suppression of the cross section. When you go to large tan beta again, you see a larger cross section. But since now the mass in the loop, okay, is just a B quark, the scale for the loops is set by the transverse momentum of the jets and no longer by the quark mass. And so you see a much more rapid fall off as a function of the A mass. Okay. This the same thing here. This was for inclusive cuts. The same pattern here for vector boson fusion cuts. Okay, so we have those tools. Now the next question is there any chance to actually isolate Higgs plus 2 jets from gluon fusion processes? Okay. And for this analysis, actually, we were interested in Higgs masses, first of all, standard model-like Higgses, okay, so relatively low masses, 115 to 180 GeV or so. And in that region, we can use the large top mass limit. Okay. So this is in the MT going to infinity limit. Okay. It's, if you are interested in details, you can see it here. What we are interested in is the following. Okay, for the standard model Higgs, it has a CP even coupling to the top quark. Okay, so we can parameterize the interaction with the gluons by this effective Lagrangian, field strength squared. Okay, if there's a gamma 5, instead we get a dual field strength, we get an epsilon tensor into the vertex. Okay, so one question is, can we distinguish these two different scenarios? Okay. Another thing which is also you see from here also, there's a factor 1, yeah, 1 over 12 to the factor 1 over 8 here. Okay. So the production cross section for the pseudoscalar Higgs is going to be larger by a factor 3/2 squared. Okay. That's a nice enhancement factor for the pseudoscalar, which we'll exploit in the following. The first signal we looked at was for Higgs to WW. Okay. From the vector boson fusion studies, we know that Higgs to WW, Higgs mass 160 GeV, branching ratio to WW is essentially 100%, is the optimal case. If you can't see it there, you won't see it anywhere. Okay. So let's start with the easy case. Backgrounds, as before, W pair production from electro weak processes. Now that does include the Higgs signal in vector boson fusion. That's now a background to the gluon fusion study. PT bar production with additional jets can give rise to the same signature, and QCD corrections to W pair production also. Okay, so we have looked at these with relatively inclusive cuts asking for 2 tagging jets, okay, but no large tagging jet separation yet, 2 identifiable leptons, which would also trigger the event, okay, and decent separation of the leptons and the jets. Okay, we get cross sections like these. So the signal, including branching ratios to 2 charged leptons, about 100 femtobarn, but the PT bar backgrounds are in the 20 picobarn range. So TT bar is the dangerous background, of course. Fortunately, there are some differences, but now you also see why vector boson fusion works so well. Okay, this is the delta eta separation between the two jets in the event. The green curve here, unfortunately, is not the gluon fusion signal; it's the vector boson fusion Higgs signal. Okay, you have a nice separation. So if you zero in on this region, we have a good rejection of the background. The signal that we have now in gluon fusion, that's this blue curve here. That behaves just the same way, okay, as far as the separation is concerned, as all the other QCD backgrounds. So it's just QCD correction to the gluon fusion triangle. Okay. Digit invariant mass, exactly the same thing happens. The gluon fusion signal and all the QCD backgrounds look just the same, but vector boson fusion is readily separable.
These are all normalized distributions, right?
Yeah, these are all normalized distributions. And just with the inclusive cuts. Okay, you'll see what happens with some cuts with the event rates in just a moment.
What is the mass?
160 GeV for the Higgs. Okay. So the way to get the backgrounds down is to use exactly these tricks which I discussed before there on the blackboard for the vector boson fusion. Okay. So the separation of the two leptons, okay, is relatively small. You see that here. Separations below 1.5 or so are typical. The backgrounds all peak at much larger separations. So the backgrounds mostly have the leptons back to back. The signal, the Higgs decay, the leptons are close together. This is the reconstructed transverse mass, same as over there. Okay, you see a nice peak here for Higgs decays, while the background is quite wide. Okay, so with these additional cuts, okay, you can zero in on the Higgs signal, but of course the weak boson fusion Higgs signal and the gluon fusion Higgs signal have the same properties here. Okay, I'm really zeroing in just on Higgs events, but it helps to beat down the TT bar backgrounds, and that's shown here. So I have I lose about a factor 3 with these cuts for the Higgs signal, but I get the TT bar backgrounds down to something like a factor 2 larger than the overall Higgs signal.
This is the leptons.
Yeah, it's essentially the lepton separation cut, the and also the transverse mass cut that helps you.
So you have to know what transverse.
Yes. Basically, the idea here is you have already seen the Higgs in inclusive Higgs to WW in vector boson fusion. Okay, and now you see whether you can separate the vector boson fusion and the gluon fusion, whether you can isolate the gluon fusion as a separate signal. Okay, and so the answer here would, okay, this is a particle level study, of course. Okay, so for normally you get an S over square root of B of 16. You may call the 60 inverse femtobarn when you put in experimental efficiencies also.
Going back to your question, this is part of a thread of trying to figure out whether it's a pseudoscalar or a scalar.
Yes.
But wouldn't it be the case that if you had gluon fusion without the additional associated jets, just things, without the two extra jets, you might have the Higgs to ZZ, and then you would have, couldn't you distinguish between the pseudoscalar and the scalar?
That's an alternative, but you see, for this 160, 165 GV case, Higgs to ZZ is not very obvious. Okay, so for that particular volume, this is probably the better way. Okay, well, we've also looked at this in tau tau. Let me skip that. Tau tau is more difficult. Okay, what I would like to get at in the last few minutes, sorry. May take another 5 minutes or so, is the question I raised in the beginning, tensor structure of the Higgs coupling two gauge bosons. Okay, I've phrased it here in terms of coupling here with vector boson fusion, so to two Ws, but coupling to gluons is going to be the same type of question. If I look here at this coupling, the most general structure I can write down is with a G mu nu. And then I have these two momenta, okay? So I can write down a coupling that uses these momenta also, okay? Of course, there are more terms, but all additional terms that I could possibly write down will disappear when I use the approximate masslessness of the external quarks and gluons, okay? So this is really the most general structure I can have, okay? The first one is exactly what you get in the standard model, X coupling to Ws or Zs. These two are what you get from loop-induced couplings, either a CP even coupling to, let's say, the fermions inside the loop, or the CP odd coupling to the fermions in the loop will give us a V times the dual of the field strength. Okay. So you want to be able to distinguish these three different couplings. And the thing to do is to just look at the azimuthal angle between the two jets in those events. So the two quark jets in the case of vector boson fusion, the quark or gluon jets in the case of gluon fusion, two Higgs plus two jets. Okay. For vector boson fusion here, the standard model expectation is a relatively flat distribution. If you have a CP even coupling, you have a pronounced dip at 90 degrees. If you have a CP odd coupling, you have pronounced dips at 0 and 180 degrees. And the different curves here are variations of the form factors for these anomalous couplings, which are putting in leading order versus next to leading order, change of the Higgs mass, and so on. It has little effect. You always have this pronounced dip. Okay. Now one can actually improve on this further if one has CP violation. Okay. The problem with the previous plot is, if I just plot here the azimuthal angle between the jets between 0 and 180 degrees, okay, so lining up and back to back, and I have, let's say, a CP even coupling and a CP odd coupling at the same time, these two curves add and they reproduce the standard model curve. But that can actually be resolved. Okay, that's with the following trick. Let's look at the event a little bit more globally. We have the two beam directions, okay, and two jets, and the two jets are correlated with the beam direction. I have one forward jet with respect to this beam, and a forward jet with respect to that beam. Okay, so the two jets are not equivalent. Okay. If I take the correlation with the nearest beam direction into account, I can form this invariant here. Okay, and when you calculate it, it's proportional to the sine of the azimuthal angle, and that keeps the plus minus sign information on the azimuthal angle. Okay, so I really should be plotting the azimuthal angle between 0 and 360, or between minus 180 and plus 180 degrees. And also you see that this observable here obviously is a parity odd variable. Okay? So if you get a non-zero expectation value for this, you immediately know that there's parity violation in the Higgs coupling. Okay. It doesn't matter which is plus or minus. No, but you see, the thing is, if I interchange B plus and J plus, the jet in the same direction as the plus direction, with the B minus and J minus, these pairs, this is invariant. Okay, so the sign information actually is there. Okay, so what happens when you now plot it between over the full 360 degree range? Okay, the green curve is the old CP even curve, so the dip at 90 degrees, CP odd dips at 0 and plus minus 180. Okay, but now I have a mixed case. We have equal amounts of CP even and CP odd coupling. All that happens is that the thing shifts in this plot. Okay, so if here I fold it over, which is what I did before, then this dip and this peak, of course, fill each other up, and yet I get something which looks like the standard model distribution. But with the sign information, I can distinguish it. Okay, so this distribution allows me to actually probe for a CP violation in the Higgs sector.
I'm not quite sure I understand what's being plotted. These are normalized distributions with either in the standard model case only an A1, or in the CP even case only an A2.
Yes.
Or in the CP odd case only an A3.
Yes.
And no. That if you normalize A2 plus A3 with any linear combination, does it just shift
yeah.
the entire plot?
Yeah, exactly. So here, the red curve is A2 equal to A3. A1 still set equal to 0. Okay. And all that happens is that you shift. I mean, it's essentially these three, the blue, the red, and the green distribution, okay, will have a minimum. See, if I have A2 proportional to sine alpha, A3 proportional to cosine alpha, okay, then the minimum just is shifting this way. Okay. So you don't have to know the normalization as long as you can see this modulation and you see actually where the minimum is sitting. You can measure the ratio of these two couplings. Okay. Now, for gluon fusion, it works just the same way. Okay. Here, the question is, you have in one case, just a Yukawa coupling to the top, which is proportional to unity. The other case, gamma 5, or some linear combination. Can you distinguish those? And this is for the Higgs to W, W case. Okay, you expect to see something like this. This is the CP even coupling to the top quark. Okay. This would be the thing you want to compare with, okay, namely a CP odd coupling, a gamma 5 coupling to the top quark. And you see the position, the peak and the valley interchange places. Okay. So you'll have a very, very good distinguishing power. Yeah. Yes, this is the azimuthal angle between the two jets with this sign information that I get by correlating them to the respective beam. Okay. So essentially, you are, what you're doing is you're looking along one of the beams, and you have the jet that is pointing towards you and the jet that is pointing away from you. Okay. And so the sign of the azimuthal angle actually makes sense. And so that's what the different signs correspond to. And you see the background contributions here are all relatively flat. Okay, with the previous cuts, then you expect a somewhat 10%, somewhat better here in the CP odd case, Higgs signal on top of that. Okay, and so with sufficient integrated luminosity, I mean the fluctuations here correspond to 300 inverse femtobarn. Okay, you can distinguish that. If you do a statistical analysis, you get a few sigma separation between these two different distributions already with 30 inverse femtobarn. Now multiply that by efficiency factors, and it's worth looking at. Okay, clearly this is only a parton level study so far, but I think it's quite promising. Yeah, the it's essentially think of just a top mass loop, a top loop with tan beta equal 1. That's what it corresponds to.
Oh, sorry, the 16
yeah. Okay. Okay. So we've also tried the same thing for Higgs to tau tau. You have to go up to somewhat higher luminosities. I mean, it's pretty difficult there. Okay, but if you look at this, it might be worthwhile actually studying this. Okay, so it's one of those things where with enough work put in, one might be able to actually see this. And of course, from the point of view of the MSSM, this is the more interesting scenario, okay? Because you expect, in the other case, I was looking at Higgs to WW. You don't expect a pseudoscalar Higgs to decay into WW anyway, okay? So there's a very, very strong bias that you would just see the CP even coupling, okay? But you, if there's something strange going on in the CP violation in the sense that the coupling to the top quark would involve a gamma 5 unexpectedly, then you would see those differences I showed before. Here for the Higgs to tau tau, and that's also the case that you have for the pseudoscalar Higgs in 2x doublet models. You expect a large branching ratio to tau tau, okay? Also for the heavy Higgs. Okay. Now this is for 120 GeV Higgs mass, which is actually relatively difficult. And for a heavy Higgs mass, it becomes somewhat easier, even though the rate goes somewhat down. Okay. So this is something that one should keep in mind, actually. Okay, let's get to the finish line. So I hope I convinced you that Higgs plus two jet events do have some very useful information on Higgs properties. Okay, so coupling measurements at order 10% level should be possible eventually at the LHC. Now, we are probably talking 2015 here. Okay, this is not something that you're going to do in the first couple of years. the obvious source of Higgs plus 2 jet events, of course, is vector boson fusion, but gluon fusion is another important source. Okay. We do have the full one-loop calculations, which, of course, are the leading order contributions here, including the top mass effect, the quark mass effects available for Higgs and A production and also for interference between CP even and CP odd couplings. For MH equal 160, we have done a study for Higgs to WW into leptons, and what we find is that that channel actually should be visible at the LHC. Okay. Higgs to tau tau is somewhat more challenging. Okay. And the nice thing here is that the azimuthal angle separation between the two jets actually does carry crucial information on the CP nature of the Higgs couplings. So it's worth actually measuring that. Okay, thank you.
Peter, it's certainly a very nice point, this azimuthal angle correlation and staggering effect. I've been a little bit confused here, so I'm sure you thought about this. When you talk about sine, by correlating the jets with the beam directions, this is a proton-proton collider, so I'm just wondering about the overall symmetry. If you work this out and you're satisfied with them,
yeah, that's why I went through, why I showed this this plot here. The requirement is that the two jets are in separate vector hemispheres. Okay, so there's one jet which goes into the direction of the beam, let's say along the minus the z-axis. The other jet which goes in the direction of the beam along the positive z-axis. Okay, now I form this product here. Now you see, the interchange of the two proton directions corresponds to the 2 plus momenta being interchanged to the 2 minus momenta. Because at the same time, also these corresponding jets will need to be interchanged. And if I interchange these two versus these two, nothing changes. Okay. So the correlation has the full sign information.
Interchange into some CP transformation?
No, CP is not possible because I don't have a CP. My initial state does not have that. Exactly. We can compare to an antiproton, antiproton.
I have a similar confusion at the end.
Okay.
Can you really define this as a CP odd?
No, no. This is a parity odd observable. Okay. But the easiest argument is if I do it for the gluon fusion process. There, all the other vertices, of course, are parity and charge conjugation even because it's just QCD interactions. Okay, and if you look at the possible couplings of the Higgs with the two gluons, okay, you see that all the operators are going to be charge conjugation even. So if it's parity odd, it's CP odd. Okay. So the and the same also for the operators you can write down for Higgs coupling to W's or Z's. Okay. If it's parity odd, it's going to be CP odd as well, because the only way you can write a parity odd coupling is with an epsilon tensor. You can't, with this observation, you cannot prove that you have CP violation. Okay. You can prove that you have additional parity violation. Okay. But if you think of how this could be realized, I mean, that's almost as good.
More questions? Thank you.